You have a question.
Well, it's a bit of a general question.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, in your opinion, I mean, you presented the Heisenberg picture and non-locality and so on, and one is left feeling a little bit like, one is left feeling, where is reality?
Well,
what is reality?
What is real?
What is real? So, classically, one, yeah, at least has an intuition. Do you feel that with quantum mechanics?
I think that there is a reality in quantum mechanics too, but this reality can be checked only weakly. That means that if you have a quantum system and you want to know what its real properties are, you have to find a way to observe it without disturbing it. Okay? And it turns out that there are two types of measurements you can do that don't disturb it. One is to measure deterministic operators, but that is quite limited. But on top of that, you can do weak measurements that you can find the properties of the system only if you have many replicas, and then you can find the whole information that is given by Psi in a different way. It turns out that information is really information about non-local properties of the particle, rather than saying that psi of E tells you about what happens to particles that is spread in space. In fact, by doing pre and post selection, you can arrange that each particle at a given time, you know from the post selection exactly where it is, and the psi of E tells you. While it is there, it has also all kinds of non-local properties which are described by Psi of X. That picture will become much clearer perhaps at the end of this session where I will describe exactly this story very fully. So after that, maybe you will be more satisfied. Any other questions? Yes?
So, follow up on that. If a particle having a definite position is supposed to come from the phase selection.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a non-trivial Hamiltonian, there will be instances of time at which neither the pre-selection nor the phase selection give you a definite position.
It's true. So the idea is that the particle always has a definite position, but you, in general, you will not know what it is. You will have only probabilities about your knowledge where it is. It always has a definite position. If you try, you can't follow that exactly because that following will disturb the particle, but you can satisfy yourself that it always has a definite position because you can always ask the question, if I want to know at a given time where it was, I can always do for that particular time a post-selection that will tell me at that time where it is. But I cannot do a post-selection that will tell me the whole orbit. So the idea is then, the quantum particle always has a definite position. You can't predict either by past or future where it is, but you can make sure that it always has a definite position, and all the other properties that come about in the description of psi of X are due to its non-local properties. I think it will become clearer exactly how it works later. But you're completely right. There is no way either by pre-post selection to define an orbit for the particle. You can always satisfy yourself that at any time, if you wanted to know, to check, indeed you will find the particle at a given position. But you can't speak about an orbit. Orbit is like Feynman said, the orbit can be any orbit that you like. But the particle always is at a given position and it has no local properties that explain why you get interferences and other things. Okay, but I think that picture will become clearer maybe at the end of this talk today. Any other questions? Yes?
What happens if the post-selection violates some quantum numbers, some selection rules? So in other words, it's not possible.
But it can't violate anything. By definition, post-selection is due to results of a measurement. No measurement can violate any.
No, what I'm saying is, suppose there's a conservation law that says you cannot get such and such.
Suppose
Suppose there's a conservation law that forbids such and such quantum number to appear.
Then you wouldn't have this problem.
Probability zero.
Then the such postulation wouldn't exist.
Okay, so there's no contradiction here.
No, no. By definition, postulation can always be thought about as a result of a definite experiment. And if that experiment cannot violate some rules, then it couldn't happen. Any other question? Okay, before I continue with my discussion of non-local interaction, the exchange of modular momentum, which will be the main part of this talk, I want to tell you another Einstein story that is interesting because it will be connected with pre and post reaction in an interesting way. And the story is like this. About 20, 25 years ago, I came to Chicago and gave a talk there. And Nambu was at that time alive yet. And he died just recently, I think, Nambu, maybe 2 years ago or something like this. But after the talk, Nambu invited me to his office, and we came and started to chat. And he told me the following story, that when he was a postdoc and he came to Princeton as a postdoc, Einstein at that time had a habit that any new postdoc that would come to Princeton, he would invite him to his office and have a chat with him. So he invited, one evening he invited Nambu to his office and they started to talk. Einstein asked Nambu, what are you working on? So Nambu enthusiastically started to tell him all kinds of things about superconductivity, he was working on it, and Einstein lost interest very quickly. So then Einstein said, well, let's talk about something else. Come with me to the window. So they came to the window. Einstein asked him, what do you see in the sky there? So Nambu said, I see the moon there. So Einstein asked him, are you absolutely certain that the moon is there? Nambu said, of course, I see it. I'm certain that it's there. Then Einstein told him, if you are certain that the moon is there, you don't believe in quantum mechanics. So Nambu told me this story, and we both smiled. Well, the old man Einstein didn't know what he's talking about. How could it come that quantum mechanics tells you that you can't have this certainty? But then we started to think about it, and I told Nambu, hey, maybe Einstein had a real point, because quantum mechanics really tells you that you can't be certain absolutely about anything. For example, suppose I want to say that I am certain now, with absolutely no doubt at all, that I'm alive. Quantum mechanics tells me, no, you're wrong. You must have a very small, exponentially small probability that you're wrong. Why? Because we know the following statement. If we have, in quantum mechanics, at a given time, psi of t, and if there is another time, t prime, so that the product of psi t prime times psi of t is exactly equal to zero, that means that this psi must have tails in energy that goes all the way to infinite. How do we prove it? Because the integral, this scalar product, if I write psi of t as an integral of g of t times eigenstate of energy, d of t and e, this amplitude of eigenstate of energy dE, I can always take psi of t and expand it in eigenstate of energy, right? And so then I see the integral of psi, the scalar product of this is the integral of this square of the absolute value square e dE times e to the iet, t prime minus t. Right? This is the result of this integral. So for this integral to be exactly equal to zero.
There's no vector there.
What?
State vector.
Sorry?
No p. There's no test state vector. No
test. Okay, sorry. The integral of,
yes,
the integral of this square d absolute. D star of D, D star of E, D of E, dE e to the IE t prime minus dE, right? This is the integral. So for this integral to be exactly zero for t prime minus c, that means that this thing must have tails all the way to infinity. Well,
you want this to be zero not for just one time t prime, but for
what?
An interval. Yes.
What is it? For
you
even
don't want the scalar product to be zero just for one precise.
Yeah.
For some interval.
Yeah, right. But suppose this is different from zero. When I take t prime, but even if I just do it for a given t prime and t.
No, because you can have a speed that goes
along. No, okay. So the idea is, suppose I want this to be equal to zero for a range of t, right? Then it means that I must have tails in energy all the way to infinity. But since I'm sure that I'm not a black hole and that I cannot have such tails, that means that I cannot be absolutely certain that I'm alive now, because I know for sure that 100 years ago I wasn't alive. So quantum mechanics tells me I cannot be sure now that I'm alive if 100 years ago I wasn't alive because of this problem. So I cannot have, from the point of view of quantum mechanics, there is nothing that I can be sure about. And I want to be sure, with no doubt at all, that I'm alive now. Right? I want to have no exponential small uncertainty about one fact. The one fact I maybe if I see you there, perhaps it's a mistake because the photon could come there to my eye and by very small chance show that you are there even though. But about my own experience that I'm alive, I want to be absolutely certain. Okay? So how do we save the day? Only if we have two vectors. Because if we say that we have two vectors that describe my state at a given time, the vectors that come from the time, from the past, tell me that I'm alive. The vectors that come from the future tell me that I have only finite trends of energies. Then the two things are consistent. The scalar product of these two vectors are exponentially close to one. Therefore, but the two-vector formulation allows me, if I say that at a given time, the state of myself is described by two vectors, one coming from the past and another coming back from the future. And these two vectors together can allow me to say with certainty that I'm alive. But if I have only one vector description, I cannot be certain about it. So I want to tell you this story to show you that here you have an example how a two-vector description has advantage compared to one vector, because it allows me to have absolute certainty about something. Think about it, it's very interesting. Okay, this was a digression, but I thought that I would like to show you how maybe Einstein had some real inkling that something is missing in quantum theory, because it doesn't allow you to speak about anything with certainty. So maybe he was very, very wise, much wiser than you think about. And perhaps when we speak about Einstein being wise, I will make another small digression and tell you about the EPR. I think what Einstein felt very strongly about the problem with quantum mechanics is the following. We should be able to distinguish between what we call subjective uncertainty and what we call objective uncertainty. Subjective uncertainty is the following. Somebody gives you a spin particle. He prepared the spin particle in the z direction. So we have now this spin particle, a subjective uncertainty about the direction of the spin in the z direction, because it did not tell us whether he prepared it up or down. But with respect to the sigma x and sigma y, we have an objective uncertainty. Nobody can know what sigma x and sigma y is. It's a true property of the particle that the sigma x and sigma y are really uncertain. But sigma z, the uncertainty sigma z is only because the guy did not tell me whether sigma z is up or sigma z is down. Now, suppose we look at an ensemble of EPR. We have a large number of particles that are pairs. Here, this particle is far away this and this are correlated to GPR, this and this are correlated to GPR, so et cetera. Now, I can decide to measure here all the sigma z's. If I measure here all the sigma z's, then in this box, the sigma z's are known to me. They are not known to the guy that is here, but they are known to me. Therefore, we can say that all the sigma z's here have subjective uncertainty. I have a subjective, if I'm sitting here, I have a subjective uncertainty about this sigma z's because the guy did not tell me yet what are the results. But the sigma x and sigma y for all these particles are objectively uncertain. They are really uncertain to every. They are real property, quantum property of being objectively uncertain. If instead I would measure sigma x in all of them, then sigma x would have here subjective uncertainty, and sigma z instead we have an objective uncertainty. There is no experimental way to distinguish between the two if we are doing experiments only on the right side. But there is a true difference between them. In one case, if I measure sigma z here, there is a lot of information here in the sigma z. Real information. But the sigma x and sigma y are completely uncertain. There is no information there at all. If instead I measure sigma x here, I change the situation here. Now there is a true information in the sigma x direction and no information in the sigma z direction. So how come quantum mechanics can't tell us this difference? Because it could tell us the difference, we should send information faster than light. So I think that what Einstein felt when he discussed this thing is exactly this problem, that he felt that quantum mechanics somehow tells you that in this situation there is two kinds of uncertainties, objective and subjective, and you can decide from far away which one will become subjective and which will become objective. So this is an interesting insight of Einstein. Einstein was very, I heard from Rosen, that Einstein was very unhappy about the way that the article was written. The Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen article was written by Podolsky. Einstein was very unhappy in the way that it was written because he felt that he did not give the message of what he was trying to say. I think what he really was trying to say is that there is something fundamentally different in this ensemble here if we do the sigma z measurement and we do the sigma x measurement. And the fundamental difference is that we change, locally we can change the question whether the thing there has objective uncertainty or subjective uncertainty, or there is information or there is no information. So I think this is a very important point. The more I learn about what Einstein says about quantum mechanics, the more I see that he was very, very wise in his criticism. He was wise in criticism that you can't have absolutely certain knowledge about anything, and here he felt that there is really something missing in the way that we discuss quantum mechanics because we can't distinguish. Or we can now locally decide whether the thing there will have information in the z direction or the thing there will have information in the x direction, subjective uncertainty or objective uncertainty. Okay, this was a digression. Is there any question about that? Because I think it's a very important point.
Sir,
yes?
I don't completely understand what the objective uncertainty is.
Say it again?
What is the objective uncertainty?
Objective uncertainty is contrary to classical physics. When we say that something is uncertain, we know that a particle is always at the definite position and velocity. We may have a situation that we don't know what it is, okay? So that kind of uncertainty is a subjective one. The particle always has a definite position and velocity, we may not know it. In general, we don't know it, and that's why we do statistical, in thermodynamics, we do statistical physics, okay? So that uncertainty that we use in thermodynamics, in classical physics, is a subjective uncertainty. It's not a true uncertainty that the particle has uncertain position and velocity, simply that we don't know what it is. So that is a subjective uncertainty. In quantum mechanics, you are told that if you know the spin in the z direction, the spin in the x direction is uncertain, not because you don't know what it is, because no one is allowed to know it is. It's a true property of the system itself that that thing is uncertain, okay? So it's not due to the lack of knowledge, it's due to a true property of the system not to have a definite sigma x. So that's an objective uncertainty. That uncertainty is a true property of the system itself, which has no classical analog at all, right? So in classical physics, we know only about subjective uncertainty. In quantum physics, a new thing is introduced, which is an objective uncertainty, a true property uncertainty, which is a true property of the system itself. It has nothing to do with the issue whether we know it or not. We are not allowed to know it. Why? Because it's a true property of the system itself that it has this uncertainty, okay? And now, quantum, and now Einstein said, look, by what I'm doing here, I'm going to change what's happening here from subjective to objective, depending on what I do here. How is it possible? There must be a difference between the two. And this difference now violates causality. So this is really the true deep thing that Einstein felt, that something is missing in quantum mechanics. Okay? Because it tells us that there is a true difference between objective and subjective one. And suddenly, you know, locally, we can decide whether it will be subjective or objective. Right? Okay. Now coming back to our story about non-locality. So, what I told you last time about the AB effect is that if I have here a region of space where I have a magnetic field perpendicular to the waveball, like a solenoid here, suppose I put a barrier around here, a barrier, so that no particles are allowed to enter inside. So any particle that moves outside, at any place here, it just sees a vacuum. There is nothing there. It's completely emptied. Locally, everything looks exactly as if it's a vacuum. And nevertheless, quantum mechanics tells us, if I have a particle that moves here, it will collect a phase which is equal to the integral of the vector potential around its orbit. If it moves here, it collects a phase which is the integral of the vector potential around here. So if we look at the phase difference between here and here, it will be proportional to the flux inside, because the integral of ADL is the flux inside. So this particle somehow experiences non-locally the effect that there is a magnetic field here. We can try to describe it locally by saying, okay, it moves according to the vector potential here. But this is not a true picture, because what vector potential we have here depends on the gauge. I can do a gauge transformation that will make all the vector potential, for example, being only here. So the particle that moves here will feel nothing. I can choose another gauge that there is no vector potential here, so the particle that moves here feels nothing. So the idea to try to describe this by effect of potential is just begging the question, because the potentials themselves are non-local. Right? So there is really a true non-locality here, and I prefer to think about it differently than the one when we wrote the article, we said, okay, there is some new effect of potential. But that is really misleading, because the potentials themselves are non-local. So there is a true non-locality here, and I prefer the non-locality as saying that the field here, which is the real thing, affects non-locally the motion of the particle. And I want now to find a new way to describe this non-locality, rather than looking at it as a local effect of the potential on the wave function. I want to show to you that there is a better way to think about this interaction. So the way I came to think about it was due to the following paradox. I invented the following paradox. Suppose I have an infinite grating with slits distant L apart. So the distance between any two, let's discuss it as two dimensions. We can do it in three dimensions, but let's simply to discuss it in two dimensions. I have a charged particle that comes with a plane wave, no momentum in this direction, just the momentum in this direction, and it comes and it goes through the grating. Now, if we want to describe what happens to it when it comes through the grating, we can use the Huygens principle and say the following. If I look at the direction in which I want to get constructive interference, I have to take directions such that the distance between this one and that will be integral number of the wavelengths here, right? So if we ask now, what is the momentum that the particle can get in this direction? The particle first moves in this direction, now we see a rays that come in this direction. We want to find what are the possible momentum that we can get in, for the particle in this direction. So we said the following. We know that the total momentum is conserved because the grating doesn't get any energy. It's very heavy, so it can get momentum but no energy. That means that the particle, when it comes out, its momentum in this direction is equal to the initial momentum in this direction to conserve energy, right? Now, the angle here is equal to the angle here. That means that Py, and let's call this direction y and this direction x. So initially, Py initial was equal to 0. And now we have the possibility for Py final, which is this one. We know that Py final is equal to P total, that's the initial momentum, multiplied by sine of this angle, right? Sine of theta. Theta n call it, well, theta n is this angle. This angle is equal to that one, right? This is n lambda. So this is equal to n lambda divided by l, right? This might be integer number of wavelengths to get constructive interference. So therefore, this angle is equal to the sine of this angle is equal to this divided by L, by this, is L lambda over L. So we see therefore that Py final must be equal to, this is times P total. It's equal to P, to the initial momentum P total, times N lambda over L. And P total times lambda is equal to h, and therefore this is equal to h times n over l. Right? So we know that the final direction where the particle can move satisfies the condition that its momentum in this direction has changed by integer number of h over l. And this we can prove also in another way, that if we have periodic potential with respect to y, then it can change the momentum in this direction only by multiples of h over the periodicity. So far, nothing is new. Now, this is new. Okay, now I change the situation, I put behind each one of these things a little solenoid. Suppose this little solenoid has a flux, half a flux of each one of them. So I have an array of solenoids that I put here, and I know that what they will do, they will change. If I look at the direction here and direction here, because of the solenoid, there is an extra phase of pi between this one and that one, because the difference around the solenoid must be equal to proportional to the flux. So in fact, now I see that the constructive direction will be instead of this, it will change. So that this distance now will be instead of n lambda, it will be n plus epsilon lambda. Right?
Whatever
thing. Yeah, but I want to take a special case, okay? My argument may be general. Simply, I want to take a special example. So I take a special example. I know now that Py final, the Py final of the electron now will be an integral plus half times h over a. Some integer plus half times h over a. And now I'm interested in the conservation of angular momentum. So there are three systems here. There is the electron, the grating, and the ray of solenoids. The sum of the momentum of all of them must be conserved in the y direction. I know that the grating can give only integer times h over l. So the extra half h over l must come from the solenoid. I don't know if it's plus half h over l or minus h over l or even more than that, but something must be exchanged with the solenoid, right? So at first, when I thought about it, I said, okay, each electron that comes by will exchange with the solenoids at least plus or minus one half h over l, maybe more than that, but at least that thing, in order to explain the conservation law. Now, the electron, the solenoids are such that the electron don't touch them. I can even put you barriers that don't allow the electron to touch the solenoid. So there is no local interaction between the electron and the solenoid. And nevertheless, there is an exchange of momentum between them, which is plus or minus half h over l. Now, when I look at the single electron, I say, okay, that has no meaning at all because the uncertainty in the momentum of the solenoid must be larger than h over l because I want the location of the solenoid to be so that the electron don't touch it. So when one electron comes by and it gives this plus or minus half h over l to the solenoid, it has no classical meaning to it because the momentum that's given to the solenoid is smaller than the uncertainty. Right? So I could not look at the solenoid and say, okay, you got this momentum. But then I said to myself, okay, suppose I keep sending one electron after the other. Each electron comes and the solenoid and sees the same effect of the solenoid. So if it's a random walk, namely each time each electron gives plus or minus half h over l, after an electron pass by, there should be an accumulation of momentum given to the solenoid of the order of square root of n times one, at least that. Because if each electron comes by and gives either plus or minus h over l, and the next electron that comes by sees exactly the same vector potential, there is no memory on what is given to the solenoid because they're heavy, they don't move. So that next election will see exactly the same vector potential as before. There could not be any memory here. Therefore, I expect that after a long, I think many, many electrons, eventually the solenoid will have to start to move because they get finally as much momentum as they like. But classical correspondence tell me that that cannot happen because there is no force acting on the solenoid. And therefore, if I see that they really start to move, something bad will happen. So there is a paradox here. On one hand, we say if we send as many electrons as we like, one after the other, eventually the solenoid array will have to start to move, and we know it's not allowed by classical correspondence. So before I continue, I want to see if you have any idea how to solve this paradox, or if you have any questions about the paradox. It's a true paradox. And this time, I did not wake up in the morning to solve it, but actually I solved it in some without sleeping. But before I do that, I want to see if you can either come with an idea or at least see if something is wrong in the way that I formulate the paradox. You have any questions about it? Of course, you always expect the answer because you know where I'm leading to. But before that, suppose you haven't heard about modular momentum. So I will tell you how I came to the idea of modular momentum. At that time, I did not have any concept of that. I told myself, if for some reason the random walk will not happen on a straight line, but instead will happen on a circle, then when you have a random walk in a circle, it can never grow, right? Because if you say that I make a random walk on a circle, I go this way or that way in the circle, but I will never go to a distance bigger than that circumference. So once I thought about that, then immediately I realized that indeed what the solenoids do to the electron, I don't know how much momentum they get to the electron. I only know that they change from some integer plus half h plus from integer h over l to some other integer plus 1/2 h over l. I don't know that the integer is the same because I don't know how much the grating goes. The grating get any integer times h over l. So the difference between these two situations is that the modular momentum has changed. So I said, okay, maybe the way to think about the interaction between the solenoid and the electron is not by saying that the solenoid changes momentum with the electron, uncertain momentum with the electron, they instead exchange modular momentum, okay? So once I thought about it, I saw immediately that I can prove it. How do I prove it? I say the following. Let's just take the two wave packets that describe an electron coming either one slit or the other slit, and I put one solenoid here. What the solenoid does is change the relative phase between this and that. Okay? So instead of, for example, having psi left plus psi right, I will go to psi left minus psi right. Or in general, if I have any flux here, I will change from psi left plus psi right to psi left plus some phase into the I field times psi right. So that's what the solenoid does. The solenoid changes the relative phase between the wave packet going on one side and the wave packet going on the other side. So once I realized that, I first of all can immediately prove that that change from psi left plus psi right to psi left plus e to the I field psi right doesn't change not only the average momentum, but doesn't change the average of the square of the momentum. Because to say that it gave it either plus half h over l and minus half h over l, it doesn't change the average momentum, but it changed the average of the square, right? But I can prove now that if there is no overlap between this and this, that change doesn't change not only the average momentum is not affected, but also the average of the square of the momentum. So that means that there is no accumulation at all. The only thing that is being changed here is the average of e to the I PL over h bar. But the average of any power of the momentum is not changed. In particular, the average of p squared is unchanged. And now, this is very interesting because historically, when both try to explain why, if you observe through which slit the particle goes, you destroy the interference, Bohr was saying that if you observe through which slit the particle goes, that observation will increase the uncertainty of the momentum, and that will make that will disturb the interference pattern because it will change the direction in which the electron is going. But it's wrong because if I take a superposition of this plus that divided by L, psi left plus psi right divided by square root of 2. And I go by observation just to psi right. The going from this to that, although it decreases the uncertainty in position, doesn't increase at all the uncertainty in momentum. Because the average of p squared of that is the same as the average of p squared here. So this observation does not change the momentum, does not change the uncertainty of momentum. It only changes the modular momentum. So what is relevant for describing interference is not the momentum, it's not the distribution of the momentum or the average of any part of it. It's only the question, what is the motor variable here? That is the only thing that is being affected when I go from this to that by observation through which slit the particle went through. So I now want to describe an interaction between two systems that happens now locally by exchange of modular momentum. So first I want to describe conservation law. The usual conservation law says that if I have one particle described by P1 and the other particle described by P2, the sum of these momentum are conserved. So this is the line where the sum is conserved. So if, for example, I started both of them with this momentum and I find one of them here, actually it's this line, right? Yeah, the sum is conserved along this line. If this is negative, this must be positive, right? So conservation law, the momentum is moving along this line. If I have any collision, and momentum of one particle change, then the momentum of the other particle change accordingly. What happens if I have no local collision, like between solenoid and electron, and only modular momentum is exchanged? How would I describe this conservation law? So let me now discuss the solenoid thing. I put here cosine P1, and I put here cosine P2, divided by P0, let's take P0 for simplicity. I want to say, what can I say about conservation law for these things? Because that will be describing what happens when you only exchange modular variables. So I know the cosine of P1 plus P2 is conserved. What does it mean? This means that if I open it, it's cosine P1 times cosine P2 minus sine P1 times sine P2, this is conserved, right? So let me call cosine P1 x, and then sine P1 is square root of 1 minus x squared, right? So I have the condition here that x1, x2, plus the square root of 1 minus x1 squared, or minus the square root of 1 minus x1 squared, times the square root of 1 minus x2 squared, is equal to some constant. I want to see what is that condition. So I bring the c here and take the square root to the other side and square root of it, and square root. So I see x1, x2 minus c squared is equal to 1 minus x1 squared times 1 minus x2 squared, right? So if I open it, I have on the left side x1 squared, x2 squared, minus 2 times c, x1, x2, plus c squared, is equal to 1 minus x1 squared minus x2 squared plus x1 squared x2 squared, right? So I can cancel this, and I see now that the condition is that x1 squared plus x2 squared minus 2c x1 x2 is equal to a constant. The constant is 1 minus c squared. But that is exactly the equation for an ellipse. So I see, therefore, that I have now a conservation law for the modular variables, which tells you that if you write your cosine P1 and you write your cosine P2, there is some ellipse here that is conserved. And the system moved along this line. So if I, for example, I know initially that this was the modular momentum for one, this was the modular momentum for the other. And then later I find that this one has this modular momentum, then I will know that this one will have this modular momentum. So I can talk now about non-local interaction as a change of modular momentum. So the interaction between the solenoid and the particle is described not by exchange of momentum or by exchange of the swell of the momentum, but by exchange of modular momentum, which means that the system moves on this kind of run. It's really a conservation law that has to do with product rather than sum, because what is conserved is e to the I P1L times e to the I P2L. It's similar to conservation laws of parity, for example, where the product is conserved. So when you have conservation of product like this, it means that you move on this kind of ellipse. Now comes the next question, when does this exchange take place? The electron comes by the solenoid. At what time do they exchange that modular momentum? And a very surprising result comes about. Let me show you that surprise. Here is the solenoid, the barrier here, and I have a particle that moves in a superposition here and here. So this is a wave packet here and a wave packet here, and the particle moves like this in time. The particle is collected, I can collect the particle with an imaginary line like this, and say that when the two wave packets come here and the line crosses the magnetic field here, that is exactly the time when the modulo was exchanged. Just to that instant. If this is very infinitely thin, let me prove it to you. Let me choose, first of all, a gauge. I'm going to discuss a gauge invariant quantity. Namely, I will not speak about the exchange of the modular momentum, but the exchange of the modular velocity. Okay? Because I want to talk about a conservation law for gauge invariant quantity. So when you have a particle that's moving freely, the modulo of the velocity is conserved because the probability of the velocity is conserved. So therefore, this time e to the I VL dV will be conserved. The average of any modulo variable or any exponent is conserved when the particle is free, right? So I can say, first of all, a free particle, all its modulo variables of the velocities are conserved. Now, I said that when the particle goes through here, I will prove that there is a change in the probability of the velocity.
This is the transverse velocity.
Mm-hmm. What?
This is the transverse velocity here.
Yeah, right. It's the velocity in the direction. Yeah, that I will show that the integral of the probability of the velocity in this direction changes just when this line crosses this point. Exactly that instant. How do I prove it? I first look at a special gauge. Because I'm discussing gauge invariant quantity, I can choose any gauge that I like for the vector potential. So let me choose a gauge where, if this is a solenoid, I choose a gauge, first of all, a single gauge, where the vector potential is different from zero only along this line. I choose here a very narrow thing, very, very large vector potential here, so its integral along this line is equal exactly to the flux, okay? So if this is the width of it, there will be here, in this gauge, only here there is a vector potential whose integral in this direction is constant and equal to the flux, right? So and when I have wave packet moving here and here, when it passes through here, it changes. This one changes the phase by exactly that integral. So this was psi left, psi right, and immediately here it will be psi left, and here there will be e to the I phi times psi right, where this phi is proportional to the flux. And that change happened just when this line crossed that singular vector potential. Now immediately after it crosses it, there is no vector potential anymore, and therefore the momentum in this direction is equal to the velocity. Only here the momentum is not equal to the velocity, because the velocity is the momentum minus the vector potential. You know, if I have an Hamiltonian, which is px minus ax squared over 2m, for example, in the x direction, then velocity vx is equal to px minus ax, right? E times x. Okay. Then some, the Hamiltonian exactly is px minus e over c ax squared divided by 2m. So the velocity is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to px, which is, it means that it's px minus e over c ax divided by m. So when you have a vector potential, the velocity is not p, but it's p minus e over c a divided by m, okay? 1 minute. That means that when I pass from here to here, there is no vector potential anymore here, and therefore here the velocity is again equal to the momentum. And therefore the average velocity, the average modulo velocity is the same as the modulo momentum. So since we have shown that the modulo momentum depends on the phase phi, that means that we have shown now that here there was the modulo velocity was equal to 1, and now it changes to something that depends on phi, and that change happened exactly when this line was crossing this vector potential. Now I can do the same calculation now in any other gauge. And it will still be true that the change of the velocity happened exactly when this line crossed, because it gets invariant. That means that although now we have different phase here compared to that because it depends on the vector potential, but when I calculate the average of that quantity, it will change exactly at that time. So this is very interesting. Not only we have a non-local exchange of modulo momentum or modulo velocity between the solenoid and the particle, it also happened in a very strange way, suddenly as a function of time. Very, very dramatic thing. And you will see that there are many interesting consequences of this. So let me stop for a minute and let you ask questions. The first question there. Yes?
Isn't this a simultaneity line?
What?
The line that you are describing, isn't it a simultaneity line? Is it the line of simultaneity?
Huh?
Simultaneity?
Yeah, but when I go to another law transformation, I have to change also the direction of the momentum. So it depends. What?
And it comes invariant? Mm?
What?
It comes invariant?
Yeah, everything will be invariant. Because if I consider the change in the module velocity in all directions, it will always be the same. So if I look in another frame of reference and then move slightly, a time delay, this move first and that move later, then the modulo velocity will be along that direction. So it gets invariant. What is really exchanged is e to the I p dot l. This is the thing that and actually in fourth dimension it's p mu l mu. It works fine, but that's a complication that I don't want to get into. But it works covariantly, there's no problem at all in that. Any other question? Okay, after intermission I will show you other dramatic examples of these kinds of non-local exchanges, and I will claim, the general claim that I will make is that if you have any scattering between two systems, that scattering has local aspect to it and non-local aspect. The local aspect is due to the possibility that two particles were touching each other, and the non-local aspect is due to the exchange of the modulo variables. And in fact, to understand really what happens in scattering, you have to learn to think about the non-local exchange on top of the local one. And this will become evident after the intermission. So, shall we have intermission now? Okay. No, if it only has some weeks.
No, in that part. Then is the part we want to do. after going through that electron, it's a switch on to the on the panel.
If you mean if you switch on the solenoid?
Yeah.
No, if you switch on the solenoid, then you send extra forces, and the battery knows about it.
Yeah, then but after the solenoid, after through, passing through.
Yeah. No. No. If you switch on the flux, you change the pattern of time. Then you might there is some gauge invariant statement about how the electric field is changing everywhere. Because the particle is now affected in its motion by the electric field that comes from the change of the magnetic field, and they tell you exactly what's happening in a gauge invariant way by having to take into account the electric field the particle is feeling. That's a small complication, but it can be
explained. Okay, the gauge invariant quantity
is let's discuss it privately because it's a bit complicated. You're right. There is an interesting question to ask. But if you calculate the change in the probability distribution of velocity, you can do it for any problem. And then in this case, you will get an extra change in the probability because of local forces detected on the particle on its motion when you do that.
Right.
Now. Just to make sure that you understand how the gauge invariant works, if I have the solenoid here, and I choose now a single gauge which is in this direction, and the particle is moving here, and now because the particle did not, there was no vector potential here, the particle is still no phase at all. So what happens? But if you calculate e to the I px, minus that is f minus a x l. You calculate the average of that. This is equal to the average of e to the I p x l times e to the integral of a x dx from x to x plus l. This is true for any function that you put here. So that means that when I calculate the modulo velocity here, although the modulo momentum did not change, there is extra effect on the modulo velocity, which is the integral of A along here. Because that is the formula for how to calculate the modulo of the velocity. It's equal to the modulo of the momentum times the integral of A from here to here. So if there is a contribution of A here, that explains why the modulo velocity has changed. I leave it to you as an home exercise to prove that e to the I px minus any function of x times l, that this operator is the same as e to the I px l times e to the I the integral of f of x dx from x to x plus l. Prove this as a general theorem, mathematical theorem. You can do it quite easily, but I leave it as an exercise. If you do it, I will prove it next time. Okay, another example, which will give us more intuition about this model of change, is the following. Suppose I have a long cavity like that, and I have here...
Can I ask one more question? So you seem to be showing there is action at a distance by a straight line.
I show that the modulo velocity has changed, but it turns out that in order to measure it, you must have some finite time. Because there is no way to introduce in the Hamiltonian a term which is e to the I modulo momentum, because that will make the particle jump from here to here.
Yes.
So though the probability of the velocity changes instantaneously, to check the change, I will need some time. In fact, the time is more than L over C. You can prove it. And therefore, there is no way to violate causality. Okay, but that...
But what I was bothered about is that it happens on a straight line. It happens on a straight line.
Yeah.
In space-time.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
If you go to another node...
Background metric,
mm-hmm.
What is that line?
If you look at e to the I, you have to look at e to the I p say P mu of N mu, and you can choose N mu to be any function and do this thing covariantly. It's a bit more complicated, but it can be done.
Even in a background metric, yeah. Which varies in
yeah.
space and time.
Right.
It's yeah. still completely
complicated. Yeah, you can. It's a very interesting question, but
and
it can be
what's
done.
The line? What
now,
is the line?
Let's discuss it privately. I admit that I didn't look at it in the context of general coordinates, but I know now intuitively how to do it.
That. I looked at papers that are considering long strings, and they have done that in the,
with modular
variables.
Okay,
yes.
It can be done, and we can discuss it. Okay, suppose I have a long cavity like this, and this thing is a perfectly reflecting mirror, but I can move it if I like. Okay, so I can decide to move this mirror whenever I like. And suppose I have now a particle, so let me make it grow it bigger. This is now the one dimension. I have in this one dimension, I have first of all infinite potential here, and here I have also a reflecting mirror that I can move whenever I like. And suppose I have now a particle that is described by wave packets. It moves back and forth inside this cavity. And I assume that this particle has the property that the average velocity is very large compared to the uncertainty velocity. So for a long time, this wave will move back and forth without appreciable spread of the wave function. Okay. So now I say the following. If I have, again, my cavity, I keep the mirror fixed here at a given distance. So this distance is L, the size from here to here is L. I have a wave packet that has an average velocity V average, which is very, very large compared to the uncertainty velocity. So this particle moves back and forth many times before any appreciable spread of the wave function. So let's forget about the spread of the wave function. And I say, therefore, that if I wait time 2L over V average, the particle will come back to its initial state, right? And therefore, I can say that if I look at the operator e to the I minus I, the Hamiltonian h times t divided by h bar times the initial state psi is equal to the same state psi multiplied by a particular phase phi. Because I know that after this period t, where t is equal to 2L over V average, if I can neglect the spread, the wave function can back to itself. It can be only multiplied by a given phase. Right? So that means that in this problem, although I don't know the average, I don't know the energy, I know the modulo energy. Because I know that E modulo h over t is equal to, suppose phi 0, for example, then it will be equal to 1. Otherwise, it will be equal to to what? Something different. To phi over 2 pi multiplied by h over t, right? So let's take an example where phi is equal to 1. This formula will be equal to 0. Otherwise, it will be cosine phi times h over t. Okay, so in this case, e modulo h over t is equal to 0. Okay? Now, suppose while the particle is far away, I suddenly move this mirror by distance delta L. And delta L is very small compared to delta X. What will happen now? What will happen now is that when the particle goes up to here and comes back, it will come back shifted by 2 times delta L in this direction. Right? It will be less by 2 times delta L because it has to cover a bigger distance during this time. So then I know that e to the minus I h t divided by h bar times psi now will be equal to the one that was before, but multiplied by what happens when I shift this by distance delta L. Therefore, it's multiplied by e to the I p average 2L to delta L times p average divided by h bar. Because if I shift that by delta L, it's the same as applying the operator e to the I p delta L. Now, p is equal to p average plus minus delta p. Delta p times delta L over h bar is negligible if delta L is very small compared to delta x. So I'm left with a definite phase multiplied by psi. That means that when I shift it from here to here, I change the modulo energy from zero to something different from zero. So here is an example of non-local effect. A particle comes from here and collides with its mirror twice so that it moves it from here to here. If there is no particle here, because I start with the mirror at rest and the mirror is left at rest, there is no change in the energy at all. But if there is a particle here far away, there is a change in energy. So there is a non-local effect here of exchange of modulo energy between the particle that comes here and is responsible for moving the mirror and that particle which is far away at the time when this mirror is moving. So here is an example, another example of non-local interaction between two systems, that system that comes here and is responsible for moving the mirror, and that system which is far away when I do it, and nevertheless, because modulo energy is conserved, if the modulo energy of the particle inside the box has changed, that means that the modulo energy of the particle that moved here must have changed, and there was an exchange of modulo energy, non-locally.
What is the H that you take? Because the Hamiltonian...
The H is the Hamiltonian of this whole system, apart from the opener, through the walls, etc. And because the wall, the mirror is at rest, the only contribution to the total energy of the box plus the particle inside is just the energy of the particle inside. Right? I have here altogether a moving particle that's responsible for moving the mirror. A mirror, a box, and a particle. If the mirror starts at rest, it's a very, very heavy mirror. So if it starts at rest, although it has uncertain momentum, it has no uncertain energy. And therefore, when I move it from here to here, when I finish moving it, the energy of this is zero. And the only energy of the whole of this whole system is the energy of this. And because that energy has changed, because its modulo has changed, then the energy distribution of this must change to compensate for the change in modulo energy. So there is no local exchange of modulo energy between this particle and that particle. So now, immediately run into the question, when I do that, how can it know whether there is a particle here or not? Suppose I just put the particle in one frame immediately before that, or another frame I put it immediately after that, how could something change? Doesn't work. So the only way that it can work is that under this condition, the modulo energy of this thing must be completely uncertain. Otherwise, I'm in violent causality. Why is it completely uncertain under this condition? So let me remind you, first of all, how did I prove that if I have a particle whose wave function in position is localized inside the region L, then the momentum modulo H over L prime, if L prime is larger or equal to L, is completely uncertain. How do I prove it? If I look at e to the I p PL prime divided by H bar, its average in this state is equal to zero, because when I shift it by a distance L prime that is larger than L, there is no overlap. And this is true for any integer here. So the fact that the average of any e to the I PL prime over H times any integer L is equal to zero means that that modulo momentum is completely uncertain, has equal probability for each thing. Remember, if I have something like an angle, and I say I have a probability of theta, such that the integral probability of theta e to the I n theta d theta is equal to zero for every n different from zero. That means that probability of theta must be completely constant, right? That means that theta is completely uncertain. Now, this theta is the same as this thing. This behaves like an angle. So the momentum modulo H over L, I can think about it as the angle, and this angle is completely uncertain if I know that the particle is localized inside the distance L. Now let's see if I can do the same thing for energy and time. Okay? So what do I know about the condition here? There is something moving here that opens, that shifts this by delta L and finishes shifting it before this particle can come here. I want to, it to be local, non-local effect. That means that this particle must pass this region at a given period of time that is smaller than the time that it takes the particle to come from here to here. So I have now a wave function psi for this particle, psi of t. I take a scalar product of this with psi of t plus t. This might be completely zero, because I want to make sure that this particle passes that thing before that thing can come, so for it to be non-local. That means that the energy modulo H over T for the opener, for the outside particle, might be completely uncertain, the same way they proved it for the modulo in position. So there is no violation of causality here, because there is no way to observe on this particle that this modulo energy has changed. How can I rent a situation where I will be able to observe it? Suppose I rent that this pattern comes in superposition of two times, namely this is my box. And now I rent that this pattern comes here to open this is in superposition of wave packet here and wave packet there. The distance in time between this and that is exactly equal to t. That means this comes here when the particle is far away. Or instead, this comes here when the particle is far away. But now I can show that if this will be multiplied by one phase, and this will be multiplied by a different phase. And that means that the modulo energy indeed has changed, provided I don't know whether I open it one time or it's another time. So this is a beautiful example of a non-local exchange, not of modulo momentum, but of modulo energy. Let me stop here for a minute and see if you understand everything that I said so far. How do I know that if the second wave packet will change phase differently than this one? When this one comes and shifts the mirror from here to here, the mirror gets a phase which is the momentum of the mirror times delta L. That is completely uncertain because the momentum of the mirror is very, very uncertain. It goes to an orthogonal state. If the second comes, again it gets the momentum times delta L. There is the same uncertainty, but there is an extra momentum that was given by that particle. That extra momentum is known. It's the momentum, two times the momentum average. So although this phase is not known and this phase is not known, the difference between the two phases is exactly 2p average times L over H bar. So that's how the exchange happened. So this is a very nice example of non-local exchange, at this time of modulo energy compared to modulo momentum. And I want to show you now some very interesting implications of that. But I want to make sure that you understood it, because I did it quite fast. Let me, by the way, mention that this thing is discussed very carefully in our book. It is, right?
But I wanted to make
This example is discussed in the book?
Yeah.
Daniel.
Yes, but yeah. The way you drew it here.
Yeah.
It's a little misleading because it makes it seem like the mirror could absorb some of the energy.
No, because I said the mirror was the beginning of the earth and the end of the earth.
Why should it be addressed at the end? The way we do it in the book is we have two collisions.
The two collisions that make are responsible for starting the first and at the end being the first.
That's right, so the particle outside hits the.
That is just a question, how can a particle come here? Move it, and then leave it at rest. At the end of it, it leaves it at rest again. So the important thing is
That's right, it collides twice. Once in this direction.
Yeah, but that's irrelevant. That was happened with one wave packet. One wave packet comes here and arranges to move from here to here. The way that it does it is by two collisions.
Yeah.
But at the end, the mirror is at rest.
Sure, I just think it's easier to understand why the mirror doesn't contribute or
it doesn't contribute because it starts at rest and ends up at rest, that's all. By the way, this discussed, if you are interested in the detail, this is discussed carefully in our book, I think. So you can read the chapter there and see the discussion. But I want to, nevertheless, if you have any questions about it now, I'm willing to entertain it. Yes.
So for this to be non-local effect, you take capital T to be the time of the return.
The time comes from here to here.
Right, but one would think after the thing bounced back, you can still have interaction at the distance. So why isn't capital T just the time of interaction where particle was a mirror?
No, because
after the particle went to the left, you can still have interaction at the distance.
No, I'm just saying that I want that the part of this part interact with the mirror only when this is far away, right? Because if when this particle interacts with the mirror, this particle has a chance to hit the mirror, then there will be a local exchange of energy between them.
I understand, but I don't understand why the relevant time scale is the time of flight along the tube,
because
not the time of the flight of interaction of the particle with the nearby region near the mirror. Wouldn't that be more relevant time scale?
No, because that time scale, when it moves from here to here, that doesn't matter if the particle was here or the particle was here or the particle was here. In all these cases, it will be non-local. So the relevant thing, whether it's non-local or local, is whether you finish that interaction before that particle has the time to hit it. And that time is of the scale of L, of T. Okay. You have a question?
Yes, so could we separate H into H of the particle and H interaction?
Yeah.
Is it clear? Which is the property of the particle that changes? H at the moment is H of the total system.
First of all, suppose there is no collision here. That's a mirror.
Okay,
yeah.
Just a mirror.
Then, when
so H is of the particle.
H of the particle is P squared over 2m. Plus V of X. And E to the IST is that total energy. Okay?
But then you change V of X.
Yeah, but after I change it, it's a new V of X, and I can calculate the Hamiltonian with the new V of X. And I'm saying that when I calculate the Hamiltonian with the new V of X, the modular energy with the new V of X is different from the modular energy with the old V of X. Because that was I calculated. I calculated first with the old V of X and then with the new V of X. Right. So it's the total energy, P squared over 2m plus V of X.
So the energy has not changed, but the modular energy does change.
Yeah. And by the way, this is completely. It's very important to
realize. The average didn't change. What? The distribution must change since.
The probability of the energy has changed in such a way that when you calculate.
The powers of the energy have not changed.
Now, notice that this is really a quantum effect. We can see the following thing. Suppose we have here an electromagnetic theory. Suppose we have here a pulse of electromagnetic radiation that is different from zero here, classically. Obviously, when I change the mirror from here to here, I changed all the frequencies because I have now new normal modes. So I can say that I've changed the future behavior of that thing, right? But it doesn't cost me any energy, no changing energy, because the energy of this radiation is that the integral of E squared plus B squared here. So the fact that this change of all the modes cost me real energy, or modal energy, is a true quantum effect. Although it's true also in classical interference of waves, that if I have a wave localized here that moves back and forth with velocity of light, and while it's there, I shift the mirror from here to here. Mm-hmm. So it's true also classically that this shift has done something. It is going to change the future behavior of this thing. It changes all the normal mode. But this doesn't cost you any energy at all. Because the integral of the energy in the classical physics is the local thing, the integral of E squared plus B squared. So although the future behavior has changed, the energy didn't change at all. So this no locality is only due to quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And it's not due just to interferences, change of modes, etc. This is not what it is. It's something completely new in quantum mechanics, and when H bar goes to zero, this doesn't happen. It's very important to realize. Because many people try to say, oh, what you are discussing is just properties of interference of electromagnetic waves and nothing more. But it's not true. There's something more in quantum mechanics that although the behavior is a function of space-time will look the same, interference will look the same, everything will look the same, apart from the fact that in quantum mechanics when I do this I have to pay the penalty that I change the energy distribution, and this is not true classically. So it's a very important difference between classical wave theory and quantum so-called wave theory, which is not really, this non-locality is only feature of quantum mechanics. Now,
I have a question.
Yes.
If that's the situation, may I come on the situation, that the mirror itself has a crush up object.
Yeah.
Then there's no considering the uncertainty.
No what?
No consideration of the uncertainties.
No, I can think of the mirror as a quantum object that has a very large mass, a very small uncertainty in position, very, very small compared to wavelength, but zero energy, because the uncertainty in position doesn't cause an energy. The energy is m times v squared,
yeah.
And the average of v squared of this mirror times m is zero, if m goes to infinity.
Uh-huh.
So I can consider the mirror as a quantum object, there's no problem. Any other question? Okay, let me show you something interesting, how you can think now about any collision as a sum of local and non-local effects. Suppose I look at the same problem here, and first of all I realize that if I shift the mirror by an integer times the average momentum defined for me here, an oscillation that has a wavelength, right? The wavelength is h divided by the average of the momentum. If I shift the mirror by an integer of this wavelength, there is no change in the modular energy, because I have shifted the change of the phase will be exactly 2 pi. So I see that for the non-local effect, it's important whether I change it by integer number of wavelengths or less or more, right? So now I observe something very interesting. Suppose instead of looking at this problem, I now look at the problem when the particle is exactly in eigen state of energy but with very short waves. So I have a very highly excited mode which fits exactly into the number of waves here, okay? Now, what will happen if I move it suddenly, the mirror, by distance lambda minus delta, slightly less than lambda. If I move it by a distance slightly less than lambda, and I ask what mode will I go into, I will go into a new mode that will be slightly smaller than the lambda before. Because I tried to fit integer lambdas into a distance slightly smaller than lambda, there will be n plus 1, but not lambda, slightly less than lambda, right? That means that in fact I increase the energy when I move that mirror by a distance slightly less than integer lambda. How do I understand it? Because I know that if I move the mirror this way, the particle hit the mirror, collide with it, so I must actually get energy. And I showed here that the probability is very close to 1 that I decrease the energy. The answer is that when I do this, there is a local and non-local interaction. When I move the mirror from here to here, there is a local interaction which is proportional to the probability that the particle was actually here, which is very, very small. With that probability, indeed, when I move the mirror, I will get a large amount of energy, but with very, very small probability. But in most of the cases, when I move it, the particle is far away. So I have only a change of modulo energy. The change of modulo energy, when I do it by integer number of lambda, doesn't happen. I do it by slightly less, it goes as if I decrease lambda. So in most of the cases, I will find that I increase, that when I do this, I increase the energy. Very rarely, the mirror gets a lot of energy, and I decrease the energy. On the average, I get the classical thing that I decrease the energy when I open it. But it works in such a way that very rarely have a local effect on which the opener, the thing here, gets a huge amount of energy. And in most of the cases, the particle was far away when I did it, and I decreased the energy. So you see, I can think of any interaction, any scattering, as a sum of local interaction and non-local one. The local interaction goes according to classical intuition, and the non-local one behaves in a non-classical way, because when I do it by actual integer times lambda, there is nothing happens for the non-local one. I don't exchange modulo energy. So if you learn slowly to develop intuition, what happens to the non-local part of the interaction, you can find out a new way to think about all scattering in quantum mechanics as being a combination of local effect and non-local effect. The local effect behaves according to the classical rule. The non-local effect, because it's periodic, has completely new rules. It has the rule of conservation law of modulo variables that go in a circle instead of ellipse, instead of linearly. So if I open here by a distance slightly smaller than lambda, the only way to understand why most of the cases I will find the particle with energy smaller than, larger than it was before, larger, even though classically I can only take energy from the particle. I give energy because of the non-local exchange of the modulo energy. This is very important to develop intuition. What is new in quantum mechanics is to think of any scattering as a sum of local interaction and non-local interaction. And the non-local interaction goes completely against our usual intuition. We have to develop new intuition. What happens when we have non-local exchanges? So the lesson of all of this is that we have to learn in quantum mechanics to think not only about the usual variables, but about the modulo momentum variables, modulo energy variables, and they tell us really new aspects of interactions. They are non-local, and they can explain much better than the usual way of thinking about by interferences, etc. This is very complicated to understand if we do it with Schrödinger wave, what happened here, but with the modulo energy, I could immediately discuss many more complicated things. For example, if I have two things like this, the mirror here, there's a particle here, there's a particle here with different wavelength. Ask what will happen here, what will happen, do I increase the energy or decrease the energy? If I learn to see what happened to the modulo energy, I will understand much better the way that's happening rather than think about the usual Schrödinger picture of interferences. I think the Heisman epistle of the non-local interaction, not only, I believe, is the correct way to think about it, but it also gives you much better intuition to understand the quantum domain if you learn to think about it carefully. Any questions about that? I think that if you study very carefully this model, you will really develop a new intuition about what happened in quantum mechanics when you have scattering. Now, I will mention only that following this effect, the AB effect, a whole subject in physics that's called mesoscopic. How do you spell meso? Mesoscopic? Mesoscopic physics is a subject of physics that has to do between the micro and the macro. Microphysics is just something that happens when you have few atoms, few electrons, protons, etc. Macroscopic physics is when you have 10 to the 20 particles or something like this. Mesoscopic is a thing in between when you have, say, 10,000 atoms or something like this. That's called mesoscopic physics. And let me tell you what kind of experiments are done with this, which rely really on the quantum non-local effect. Suppose I have a wire, and this wire is now divided into two possible. It splits into wire goes like this, and wire goes like this, and then wire comes out here. And you ask what happens if an electron goes by here, the electron comes here, it has a chance either to go this way or to go that way. Why does it collide with many, many atoms? Because there are large number of atoms in this wire. So usually you would think that because of that possibility of collision with all the atoms, the atom will lose the coherence. And there will be no interference between going this way or that way. But if the scattering here is all elastic and doesn't leave any record, whether the particle went this way or that way, there will still be a possible interference here, and there could be a possibility that if the phase is opposite to each other, the particle will be reflected. If the phase is the same, there will be no current. And now the way that they check whether it's quantum mechanics or not, they do, this is actually done in the laboratory. They put a constant magnetic field here. If they put a constant magnetic field here, then there are two effects that happen due to the field. One is the local effect of the field acting on the electron, just like V cross B. And the other is the non-local effect that comes from the AB effect, from the field that is enclosed inside. Now, if there is a coherence, you expect that when you change the magnetic field, each time the field inside will be an interior flux, you will get contractive interference. If it be half a flux extra, you will get destructive interference. So when they draw the current with respect to the magnetic field, they see something that has local effect, say, maybe goes like this because of the local effect, but it has oscillation on top of the local effect that happens exactly at the right time when you integrate the flux inside. It gets to an integer. And that shows that there is still coherence left, because otherwise you wouldn't have this extra oscillation. So this shows that now it's very important to look in physics at the situation where you have both local and non-local effects. The whole subject of mesoscopic, with many, many interesting features, are all due to the fact that what happened to these electrons that moves in this kind of wire, they experience local effect and also non-local effect. And we have to learn to think about the non-local effect, which is the new feature of quantum mechanics, to develop intuition for that. Okay? I think that's time to stop. Thank you.